Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio, Walls in Our Minds. This is Dr. Kate, and I am joined by our special co-host, Red Beckman. Red, are you there?
I am here.
Good evening, Red. Many condolences to you for the loss of your son.
Well, thank you, and it's been quite a week, but we'll survive.
Thank you. And I believe we have Kirk McKenzie as well. Kirk, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. We're going to have a great show this evening with a number of sheriffs and others to talk about land use management and rural water rights and resources protection. And I'd like to start off right away and with a prayer. Red, if you're feeling up to it, we would love to have you start the program.
Very good.
Thank
Heavenly
you.
Father, we come to you asking for your guidance, asking for your wisdom, asking for your help to solve a very serious problem. We know that you are aware of what is going on and how our government has become, it seems, so very, very evil. And we just pray that you would give us the wisdom and the strength to hold up our end of this and do what we need to do combat this evil force. We thank thee for the sheriffs that have come on board with this battle, and we thank you because they have a tremendous opportunity to be of service to their countrymen. We thank thee now for everything, and we just hope that you will guide us and help us to know what to say, what to speak, and we'll give you the praise in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Red. Kirk, who is yours?
Okay, thank you very much. Listen, Red, I hadn't heard the news. I'm very sorry, and my condolences as well, particularly during this time of the year. I think we're going to have an absolutely great show tonight. For those who have been following this radio show and their support of the Defend Rural America Project, you probably have found out that by week after week after week, we're just continuing to expose and to dig in not only to the story of Siskiyou County, but the problems that besiege our nation worldwide, and particularly the rural part of that. And not only are we trying to bring out information to educate, to inform, we're also trying to bring out information about strategies and what we can do to actually fight back. And this is not just information coming from academics or theory. These are coming from the actual people that are participating, whose lives are being affected and who are directly involved in the issues. I encourage everyone that's listening to this show to continue to bring more and more people to this show every week, because we are trying to bring a focal point to how we get our country back. Tonight, I'm extremely pleased. We're going to have Sheriff Gil Gerbertson online. Gil, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And Sheriff Glenn Palmer. Glenn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. So we're going to have the first hour, hour and 15 minutes or so, we're going to actually talk about who the heck controls these public lands, what are public lands, who has jurisdiction over them. The problem comes up because some 65% or so of the western states are considered to be public land, and a lot of the problems that are coming up are because of the federal intervention in those public lands. And these are lands, you know, pretty much ignoring the people who actually live there, work there, make an industry there, their communities, and so forth. And so it's a vital interest, and no sooner had I kind of had this epiphany, hey, this all gets back to federal lands to a great extent, then I came across an absolutely superb write-up about this from Sheriff Gil Gerbertson of Josephine County, Oregon, and it's called Unraveling Federal Jurisdiction Within a State. And that PDF file can be downloaded from the Defend Rural America website on the public lands page, which just went up today. So Sheriff Gilbertson was one of those, in fact, and Glenn as well, two of those eight sheriffs that came to the Siskiyou County Watch on October 22nd, participated in the sheriff panel, and both of whom had standing ovations from an audience of some 1,000 people who had come together in unison to try and save the dams in Siskiyou County. If I could, Gil, let me start with you. Perhaps you can give us a little background or start off talking about this topic of federal jurisdiction within the public lands.
Well, I think first people need to understand the difference between public lands and public domain. It plays an overall role in all of this. Public lands are basically the lands that are out there that can be acquired for a variety of reasons. And once they have a claim against them, such as a mining claim or somebody purchases it, you know, they have a title. So if it's titled, it now becomes public domain. It's removed from public lands. And as public domain, there are private property rights and everything that comes along with private property. So that's in part where some of the issues have come from. Where this started for me was I had a federal ranger that was a wannabe, if you would, was creating all kinds of problems. I had all kinds of complaints. And I tried to do everything I can or could to have this individual move to another area. And in a subsequent research, I found that he'd been a problem in other areas, and he was still employed. So what it took was for him to take his ability away from him to use my radio. I just wanted him gone. But anyway, as a result of the complaints, I had a couple of miners come in, and they were telling me things that I really was ignorant to. So I told them, okay, I'll look into it. And as such, the more I dug into the information, the more I realized what I didn't know, and that I think that the federal jurisdiction or federal authorities have overstepped their bounds for a variety of reasons. And Glenn Palmer, sheriff in Grant County, and I have been working together on this for some time now, and we're trying to make the best we can out of this and bring things back into focus and into line, constitutionally speaking, to where they should be.
So with your paper, it's 13 pages. I call these a white paper. It's a term perhaps not everybody is familiar with. I come from the technology industry, and we used to call these white papers write-ups, essentially informative write-ups. They give a logical, cohesive analysis of some topic, and certainly yours is excellent. And there's a lot of citations, the Constitution, the law cases, and so forth. I think a good place to start with is go back to the original intent. When this country was founded, what was the original view of and intention of public land?
Well, public lands were open for seeking out minerals, developing settlements. They wanted people to move out to the western lands. In fact, they referred to them back in those days as the problem lands. And The idea was just to get people to move out there, develop some wealth. In fact, they had to pay for the war that had just been fought, the Revolutionary War and later the Civil War, but to open up those lands so that they could generate revenue, if you would, to pay those bills.
So essentially you had, 13 states that signed off on the Constitution, followed quickly by additional states, but largely along the East Coast, and we had this whole mass of land to the west, and essentially there was no title to this land, but there was, I assume, some expectation that the United States would be growing westward, and the intention, if I understood, was that the federal government, this little thing that was given 10 square miles of land as its jurisdiction, was something on the neighborhood of a trustee that was kind of holding these lands as a trust, and as soon as a state were to incorporate, these lands became property of the states. Is that correct?
That'd be a correct assumption, yes.
So under the Constitution, what authority over what lands does the federal government have direct authority?
Well, that would be under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. It specifically identified what lands and what authority or jurisdiction that they had. That would have been the seat of our government, of our national government in Washington, D.C., and any lands acquired from a state and that they were for needful buildings, the construction of forts, arsenals, dockyards, or those kind of things. Basically, that's where it stopped, and it was identified as such. But over the years, it has creeped into overexpansion of what the Constitution states.
So part of that clause, actually, for the Constitution, I'll read one phrase, and it says to exercise like authority, this is exclusive authority, it says over the district, which is now known as the District of Columbia, and like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. In other words, a minimal footprint to allow the federal government to probably conduct principally its job to help to keep the security of the country, and that's it, correct?
That's correct. That's the exclusive jurisdiction that they were limited to. But as I stated before, it's been something that's I call mission creep. It's just evolved beyond all recognition of what the Constitution originally stated.
Has there, to your knowledge, been any constitutional amendment to expand the authority of the federal government beyond what's stated here?
No, there is not.
Okay, so now the question then becomes, and perhaps since both of you are in Oregon and perhaps more familiar with the Oregon Constitution, what is it your conclusion after reading some of this information, studying this for, I guess, the last 2 years? What exactly is the authority, if any, in the federal government in the state of Oregon?
Glenn, go ahead.
From what I could, from what I obtained and some of the documents I've received, there is just a small portion within my county, which is Grant County, Oregon. There's less than an acre, and I believe it's a tenth of an acre, that is assigned by the BLM that would fall under the Clause 17 of the Constitution to where the federal government would have sole jurisdiction over that piece of property within the county. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and maybe a post office or other needful buildings for federal use.
Yeah, and that's the only thing outside of the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 that we could show any documentation outside of that there's any other jurisdiction within my county. There's less than an acre on Rodeo Mountain in Grant County, Oregon, that is a sole jurisdiction by the federal government that also falls in with those other criteria, the post offices, military dockyards. We don't have those kind of things within our county, but about 65 to 68% of our county is national forest lands, and that's where, as Gil would say, the mission creep has begun, and that's where the rub with me is the wrong way that things are starting to take place within our county that's really upsetting our economy and our schools and our government, and it's not good.
So perhaps I think I'm going to jump forward a little bit in the story on this, because the Constitution deals with this sole authority or exclusive jurisdiction concept, and that's what we've described and what you've talked about so far. Perhaps we ought to spend a moment then. Let's talk about the Eisenhower document and get on the table the idea of different levels of jurisdiction that were described in that.
Well, the Eisenhower document it was something that was done in 1956 and 1957. It was a two-part document, and each one of those sections is about 300 pages long, so it's you really got to like to read. But what it determined was that the local law enforcement was not doing any protective activities within the national forest or these forest lands, and that the federal government was not either. So as a result of all that research, they decided that there would be four levels of jurisdiction. That would be they're exclusive, concurrent, partial, and proprietorial. So starting from the top, the exclusive basically meaning they had full authority to do whatever they wanted to on those lands that they purchased or acquired or were gifted, as long as the state ceded back that authority to them and the federal government or the United States agreed to that. Concurrent jurisdiction means that the local law enforcement can cite a case either into federal court or into a state level. Partial is a matter of it can be any combination that the two parties agreed to, and proprietorial basically gives them no more authority than a private citizen to be on those lands. I'm talking the federal government itself. So that's what we have today, and if you just adhere to the Constitution, it is very limited to the needful buildings, the docks, the arsenals, the forts, post offices, and the 10-mile square in Washington, D.C. And that's been expanded on and bled over into the national forest, and that's another issue.
Okay, so now the constitutional authority of the federal government within the land, once a state was formed, the land belonged to the state, except for those lands which the state agreed to give exclusive authority to the federal government or for forts and the like. And that is the only kind of authority described in the Constitution, is it? That the Constitution does not talk about concurrent, partial, proprietorial, does it, or does it?
No, it does not.
Does not.
That was a subsequent research and document that was produced called the Eisenhower document or report.
So to some extent, just the addition of these concurrent, partial, and partial in particular is actually an expansion upon the Constitution. Is that fair to conclude?
Yes.
Okay, now, the federal forests, not the federal forests, but the forests, the national forests, the public forests that are within the state of Oregon, the federal government has what type of jurisdiction, or is it per your understanding, what kind of jurisdiction do they have?
Concurrent jurisdiction, and that was given to them. They had exclusive jurisdiction given to if they were to have a fort, an arsenal, post office, they have exclusive jurisdiction, and the state gave that back. They ceded it back to them. However, as far as a national forest goes, only concurrent jurisdiction was granted by the state back to them. But now we question that as well. It's a state law in Oregon that says that any national forest within that county has got to be voted on by the people of that county. In all 36 counties, that has not occurred. We filed Freedom of Information requests, and it was identified that no county voted on a national forest within their county. So as far as having concurrent jurisdiction, that's kind of a nullified or void issue. So that's an issue that we'll be talking about here this next month with proper authorities.
And when you say we did the Freedom of Information Act request, who was that?
There's a group out of Douglas County that has been helping doing the research, and I've also involved a couple of our state representatives, and they've had their legal people looking into some of this stuff. So there's some things that some doors have opened, and we need to take a real close look at. We've not made any final decisions. It's in the research phase, but there's a lot of things that are up in the air that really concern me.
So the best case would be is that the federal government might have, questionably has, concurrent jurisdiction. We're going to questioning that, but they act as if they have exclusive jurisdiction. Is that a fair statement?
In my opinion. Glenn, your thoughts?
Absolutely. Some of the things that I would like to share that really came to light that brought this to the front burner for me was I also received numerous complaints about a year ago this last November where I got about 8 or 9 complaints involving the use of excessive force on wood permit issues and public land issues where people were being contacted by Forest Service law enforcement personnel and they were being contacted at gunpoint. And it's not good, and it's not what we expect of our public servants to treat the public that they're to represent with somebody staring down the barrel of their gun over what has been determined to be about $3 or $5 worth of firewood in the back of their pickup. And there's road closure issues that we've had Forest Service personnel here that have retired that have come forward and told us that the road closures here in Grant County have been done so and done so illegally that there was no NEPA done on the road closures. There's no basis or purpose for the closures, that they just systematically started closing those off. And when you have a federal agent wearing a gun and a patch and a badge that signifies some kind of federal law enforcement authority and they're enforcing these laws under the name of a law enforcement officer, that's where I began to question what was going on in my county. And that's where I finally stood up, and I refused to sign a cooperative policing agreement with that agency. I tried to negotiate a contract with them, and they pretty much wanted me to agree to their terms and their conditions in the contract. And the way I see it in law enforcement within the state of Oregon, and especially with a sheriff, is that that jurisdiction solely rests with the sheriff of each county. The people empower their sheriff. The federal constitution doesn't empower the federal government. It limits and it restricts and it prohibits them from doing this stuff that they are doing. And that's where I stood up, and I pretty much came to a conclusion that it's got to stop. And I, as Sheriff Gilbertson said, we're still working with those agencies and trying to come to an understanding, and maybe later on this next month that maybe we can have some good discussions and find out where we're going to go from here.
Now, Glenn, was that state agencies or federal agencies that were shutting down the roads?
It's the Forest Service.
The U.S. Forest Service?
Yes. And if you go to look at it and realistically, you know, if a city or a state tried to close a street or a highway, they would have to do so. They'd have to have a basis or a purpose or a reason to do it. There'd have to be a crash or a fire or a flood or a power line down or a, you know, and I can understand with the Forest Service having some concerns about resource damage. And when you have somebody driving on a road here in the spring of the year, that oftentimes they get muddy and they rut the roads and they tear them up. And I can understand that side of it. But when they start systematically pulling these gates across the roads and they put up these pole barricades, it's restricting our public lands, and it's stopping us from using them. And even as the sheriff of the county, we were called out on a search and rescue one time. And there's quite a few of these pole closures. And what's happened is on each pole, on each corner of them, they have a threaded bolt that's about 2.5 to 3 feet long that goes down into the posts on the sides of the road. And the, I don't know if it's hunters or people that don't want people going up into there. Well, they've pounded those threaded bolts over, and it's and it restricted the access during a search and rescue. We were looking for a cattleman that was out gathering cattle on his forest allotment, and we always assume the worst, that somebody's either got bucked off or their foot's hung up in a stirrup or they're getting drug or whatever. And when you go up these roads and you've got a barricade in front of you, it limits my access to perform my duties as a sheriff of the county to ensure the safety and the well-being of the people that have elected me to office. And I wrote a letter to them, probably say that happened about 4 or 5 years ago, and I never did get a response back from it.
So the understanding of the road closures, let's just stick with that for a second. So the federal government has agencies basically under the executive. So these are under the President of the United States, are shutting down roads access to these national forests. I'm sorry, somebody else was trying to say something? Okay, so they're shutting these things down, and they're doing this without any coordination whatsoever with the local law enforcement or with the local legislative bodies like the county commissioners. Is that correct?
Yeah, that, correct. If I can jump in.
Go ahead, Gil.
I've been in office now for 5 years, and it wasn't until I found out what this coordination clause was all about. By their own rules and regulations, they're constantly violating their own rules and regulations. According to their rules and regulations, they're to contact every elected or appointed official within that county. And when they're required to come make that contact is in the beginning of an issue when they just have the thought this is what they'd like to do. I'm into this for 5 years now. Nobody has ever come to my office and agreed to or even offered to discuss any plans that they're involved in. Just recently, they walked in, dropped off a very thick document, and they said, this is the road closure plan, and I've got 45 days to comment. I'm thinking, well, now, wait a minute. You've been working on this stuff, I believe, from 2002, and you walk in here, drop it on my desk. You knew I was going out of state for 2 weeks. You tell me I got 45 days, and I have to make a decision. There are four different options that you have, Sheriff. And number one option is do nothing at all. So then they said, you can't use number one. So they provided me with three options. First off, I don't operate at their timetable. And I thought it was pretty callous of them not to come in and discuss any of this with me in 5 years. Now they want to close these roads. Sheriff Palmer brought up a point. For us, we need to get into these areas. It's a safety issue. If we need to look for a drug activity, they got cartels growing up there. Sometimes an ambulance needs to get up there for medical assistance. We have to do investigative work. Search and rescue is huge. Not too long back, they gave me a key from U.S. Forest Service and BLM and said, these are the master keys if you need to get in. The first gate I came to, neither key worked. So I on this road closure plan, based on what I just said, what I wrote, I'll just read my last paragraph. I recently encountered a locked gate to which neither of my two keys could open. In the future, I will cut or remove such barricade to gain access. In the event a life is lost, I will do everything within my power to see that the victim's family seeks appropriate civil remedy as provided by law. I see your road closure plan as a reckless and wanton disregard for human life and safety. If we need to get up there and somebody loses their life, sheriff departments are now being sued for search and rescue if we fail to save somebody's life. Well, if I can't get up there because I've got a gate to contend with that shouldn't have been there in the first place, and I'll digress for just a minute. In the state of Oregon, in 1901, they passed a law that said any road that's been in place for 10 years and not been objected to is a county road. All right, they're up there closing county roads. I just, you know, the whole thing's wrong. So the sheriffs now are standing up and starting to make this an issue and see if we can work through this.
Now, there's another aspect to this whole road closure thing in particular. So they're not cooperating. They're certainly not acting as if it's concurrent jurisdiction. They're operating as if it's their land. They own it. In fact, I think most people in a lot of maps even say federal lands. That's really not quite true. And they're really state lands, and the state makes a determination how to do with those lands, and they may give some kind of a jurisdiction to the federal government for very limited purposes. There's a couple of interesting things about this federal land. Another one, let's talk about the wildlands. Apparently, a wildland, the federal government can designate certain areas as wildlands if they're 500,000 acres or more and have no roads.
5,000 acres.
5,000, yes. Yeah, 5,000 acres and have no roads. So essentially, by removing a roads for a period of time, if they get away with it, these lands then become potentially in that category of now being redesignated as wild lands. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have that situation going on right now. The Wild and Scenic Rogue River. They took a bunch of thousands of acres, set them to the side, and that's good. I don't have a problem with that. But now we've got two senators that want to take another 64,000 acres and add to that. And one, they're claiming it's roadless. It is not. There is a road system up there, and I'll drive any one of them up to those roads. And two, for them to do what they did, they also need to assay the land for mineral wealth and timber and so forth. And they didn't do that. And I understand they didn't do that when they made the Wild Scenic Rogue. So they just seem to do what they want. And just if nobody complains about it, they just continue. And that's where we sheriffs are standing up and saying, no, we need to work through this and make it legal and do it right.
So by basically shutting these roads off, they're accomplishing a couple of things. One is, you know, whether we agree or not, the Agenda 21, that the whole idea of kind of rewilding large ports in the United States, getting human beings off of it, all evidence of human beings to be off of it. But they also then potentially move the land into being into this designation of a wildland. What's the significance of being designated as wildland?
Well, it's just a matter that the federal government can acquire it and basically keep people off of it.
And, so they can then take title to it by buying it or something?
Well,
I'm going to interject here. I'm going to say something real quick if I could. And I don't think it gives them a title to it, but what it does is the people that had mining claims and people that had grazing permits and people that logged, our communities solely depend and rely on that for their survival. And comes along with that is our schools, our counties, and our cities. And that's where people need to wake up and figure out where their funding comes from. And when we're timber dependent and cattle dependent and mining dependent, and when they stop these activities, what's going to happen with the people in those communities? And we can see what's happening in Curry County right now. They're putting together some kind of a process to consolidate their police services based on the fact that they're broke. They're about to file bankruptcy. And when we lose our economy, we lose our infrastructure, and we lose the ability to care for ourselves, and we depend more and more on more government. And that's not what our country's about.
It's going to
let me jump in there a bit too. I'll take a moment. The first Forestry Service head of that was the Gifford Pinchot, and there was a debate between John Muir and Gifford Pinchot, and both of them agreed with conservation. They both agree with the perpetual use and restoration of the forests, but it was the Gifford Pinchot that also believed this would be accomplished with multi-use public lands. They would be available for recreational use. They'd also be available for commercial use. And for the past century, the policy has been to encourage communities to take advantage of this. And so just like Sheriff Palmer was just saying, you know, they're I don't know what the number is, but a substantial number of the cattle that are raised in this country spend at least part of the year grazing on federal lands. There are miners who depend upon their property rights to be able to mine in and on federal lands. Again, federal or these national public lands are 65% of the western United States. I mean, we're talking about huge portions of the Rocky Mountain states and timber permits. So the economies that have grown up in rural America are tightly bound to the other two-thirds of the land that falls in this category and by the policy of the government. And what's changing now is a radical change in perspective that, no, these are exclusive to federal control. We can determine what we do or don't do with them. You guys, we don't care about you, your communities, your economies, your jobs. We want to just make sure that the Delta smelt and the coho salmon are okay. And they're doing that with no constitutional authority, as far as I can tell.
Can I interject one more time, Kirk?
Sure, go right ahead.
You let Sheriff Gilbertson digress, so I'd like to digress at least once.
Okay.
If we go back to the Constitution and you read through it, there's a section, I can't quote it verbatim, but the federal government was charged with disposing of the excess and surplus lands out here in the West. And how did they become the U.S. Department of Agriculture or a national forest when they were supposed to dispose of these? And when you look at it, when you have the timber and the mineral, and whether it's natural gas or coal or gravel or
water.
Mining issues, our water source, our water systems, the thing that I'm trying to get to, I guess, here, for lack of a better term, is where did the people end up losing control and how far back? And I think that's where Sheriff Gilbertson was talking about. It was supposed to be voted on in the inception of the state of Oregon back in either 1857 or 59, and there was supposed to be an election to where the people would allow or authorize the last I heard, there was 35 out of the 36 counties that did not vote. And here in Grant County, there was no election, and there's no record of the election that would have allowed the people to allow the federal government to come in here and take control of the majority of our county. So there's some things that we're going to try to clear up, and hopefully within the next month or so, we can maybe have some better answers on how they got to where they are and why they've done what they've done.
If I can add to that. In 1976, well, they were supposed to dispose of lands up until 1976. That's when the U.S. government stood up and said, and they wrote it in their paperwork, that the federal government now will keep those lands. And it was under the FLETMA Act, the Federal Land Management Act, that they did that. And that was in 1976. National Forest, I think, started around 1904 to start pick up steam. In 1964, the USGS actually reclassified names of roads. And this all fits together. It just compounds to bring them to the point they're at today, that they just operate on their own. We believe it's in violation of the 10th Amendment.
And I like the way you wrote this up. This is on page 6 to kind of give the listeners kind of some sense of what you have in your white paper, which I just think is excellent. On page 6, one sentence reads, by 1976, complete and total disregard for the trust obligation to dispose of public land was made clear in the Federal Lands Policy and Management Act, which states, quote, that it is the policy of the United States that the public lands be retained in federal ownership. So now not only do they say they have jurisdiction, but they have ownership of these lands. Pretty amazing considering the Constitution gives them a 10-square-mile area, and here they are over on the East Coast in a little 10-square-mile asserting now ownership of these lands.
We agree with you.
It's time for people, not just rural America, but all Americans to wake up. I mean, this is not just an issue for these, you know, people and communities, but it's for all of us, because our national treasure is our land, and we happen to be an abundantly wealthy nation because of the natural resources that we have, the abundance of water and timber and open lands to farm and to grow food and mining and so forth. And what's happening is an absolute grab for control of those things. Did you want to kind of foregressing, did you want to speak to a minute about the upcoming meeting that you're having with the, is it with the district, I forget who are you having, you're going to be having this discussion with about this jurisdiction issue. You're meeting with the, which department?
Middle of January. Yeah.
You want to talk about that a bit?
Well, there's not an awful lot to say at this point. We have well over 20 Oregon sheriffs that plan to attend. We're meeting with the U.S. attorney, and she has invited the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, so that we can sit down and talk through this thing. So we're looking forward to a very fruitful encounter with them, and maybe they can answer some of the questions that we have.
Yeah, I think we picked up two more sheriffs in Oregon today. I think we're more realistically closer to 25 or 26. But, you know, I think something down the road that we need to also remember is not only the Oregon sheriffs are dealing with this, but the Western State Sheriffs Association. I know there's some issues in Washington State. The sheriffs are getting on board. The California Sheriffs Association, and I want to say some sheriffs out of Idaho.
Idaho, Washington.
Are getting involved in this. And I think we're going to have a concerted effort basically from the Rockies in the western states of the United States. New Mexico is doing a bunch of stuff down there, but we're a little bit too far from them. But I think they're part of the Western State Sheriffs. And we're getting some stuff together. And if I could, Kirk, I would like to throw a little plug in here for the Constitutional Sheriffs and Police Officers Association that will be meeting in Las Vegas and going through some educational stuff for what sheriffs need to do to take control of their office and how they can, where they get their authority and who actually has the authority within their counties. And there's going to be an educational part. They can go online and get signed up for the class. And the public, I think they're asking for some help financially to put this on. But if people want to go check that out, they can go to cspoa.com. And maybe help their sheriff get to Las Vegas and get a little bit of education out of this and maybe get some more sheriffs on board with us throughout the United States.
And this is the Sheriff Mac event in Las Vegas at the end of January. So go ahead and get that website
Absolutely.
Out again.
I think it's cspoa.com, and you can just go check out the website. They are asking for some money, financial help, to help put this on. We're going to be at the Tuscany Inn in downtown Las Vegas, and I think it's about a three-day event from the 29th, 30th, and the 31st of January. And I don't know how many sheriffs we have signed up right now, but there are quite a few, and I would like to see more of the sheriffs signed up from Oregon, but I don't know if Gil's going to make it. I haven't heard from him on that, but I'm going to be there.
Oh, I'll be there.
And it's going to be an educational experience, and maybe we can pick up a few more sheriffs. And if some of the listeners want to help contribute financially to that, I think the people that are organizing this would be appreciative of it. So if somebody's got a little extra money that they'd like to put into this and help get their sheriffs to school and learn something about this, it would be appreciated.
And I'll jump in here. Pull out those wallets and purses, give big. I tell you, there is not a more effective way. When you listen to people like, you know, Sheriff Palmer tonight, Sheriff Gilbertson tonight, you realize that they're beginning to be the counterbalance here. They are getting organized. They are digging in. They are doing the research. They are involved in this constitutional studies and legal studies. I mean, you know, here are people that are just basically trying to keep their counties alive with small budgets, not that many people, and yet they're burning the after hours doing a lot of this stuff, which is not really in their job descriptions, but they're doing this to help to save our country. There is not a more effective dollar that you can possibly spend than to donate to this cause. So this is a meeting end of January in Las Vegas. Now, this is a closed meeting. It's just for the sheriffs, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some.
Okay.
There's some chiefs
meeting,
of police,
but...
and there's some commissioners, and I think there's some other people that are going to be permitted to go into the
but
meeting.
It's
and
an
I
invitation
think...
only, so we don't want to, you know, have everybody
Absolutely.
Start buying airline tickets to go to the meeting or so forth. It's invitation only, and should be so.
Yeah.
But this is one where we can donate, because the donations will go to the payment for the rooms and air travel and cars and so forth to support the sheriffs to come there, have this event, and begin to broaden their network base, their coordination, sharing of the information that they're doing. So CSPOA, that stands for Constitutional Sheriffs, Constitutional Sheriffs Peace Officers Association?
Correct. .com.
.com. And donate big.
Yeah. And even if they don't have a whole bunch, just a little bit would help. But if a whole bunch of people donate a little bit, it would go a long ways to help them get some of the other people there from across the country that don't have the resources to pay to have their sheriff or their representative there for them.
Now, in your paper, there are some other interesting quotes that really have to do with reinforcing the fact that it's really the states that are in control of their lands and their places. I think people, I encourage everybody to get a copy, read this. It's a quick read. It's a simple read. It's a very clear read. The next issue perhaps is this issue of carrying guns. The federal agents now are carrying guns. What gives them the authority to carry guns?
Well, we're asking that same question. There are 32 federal law enforcement agencies in the United States today that are armed and have the power of arrest. There are 32, 20 of which, if I quoted that number, 20 have the power of arrest and carry guns. You know, we question that. You've got the IRS, you've got the DEQ, EPA, NOAA, the alphabet soup. But where'd that authority come from? You know, and I'm going to, if I can, digress a little bit. I think part of the problem is the executive orders coming from the president have circumvented, and that was a word that Obama used at least twice on TV that I saw, circumvented Congress. The Constitution is real clear on the legislative power belongs to Congress. However, if you look at the war and National Crisis Act, I think it is, it was enacted in 1930.
War and Emergency Powers Act.
That's it. It was enacted in 1933, and it's been four times, I believe, continued. It's never been rescinded, but I believe four presidents since that time have continued this thing. And what it does, and the reason behind it, I believe, is it gives extraordinary powers to the president for him to circumvent Congress, if you would, and I'm using Obama's words, but that the executive orders that come down have established all these federal entities, and I think the Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, that Congress has the power to dispose of lands and make all rules and regulations for any lands they acquire and so forth. Using that as their authority, these federal entities, they've expanded on just writing their own rules and regulations and then engaging them as if they were law, or enforcing them as if they were law. And I think that's repugnant to the Constitution. I think it clearly says that they can't do that. So like I say, there's a lot of issues that hopefully the U.S. Attorney's Office and sitting down with these folks, maybe we can get some solid answers. At least I hope so.
Yeah, and one thing I'd like to add to that is...
Have the federal agents in Oregon applied for gun permits?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Have the federal agents in Oregon applied for their gun permit?
I can't answer that.
Should they?
Should they? Well, I think so. But they
as,
are their
as
own.
A private citizen. I don't have any objection to that. That's within their rights, and I'd respect that.
Yeah.
To apply for one or to have one?
To have one. As a citizen of this country, I have no objections with them obtaining a concealed handgun permit or purchasing a firearm. But as a federal law enforcement officer...
That's not my question, though. Did they acknowledge the authority of the states to control that?
Oh, I doubt it. I can't answer for sure,
but I doubt it. Did they apply to the states or their county sheriff's office or whatever to get the permission to carry the guns they carry?
They didn't in my office.
No. No. Not to my knowledge.
Now, I think they carry their own authority to do what they want to do, and seemingly that's what all these alphabet organizations have done.
Yeah. Can I step back just a little bit, Kirk?
Sure.
When Sheriff Gilbertson was talking there just a minute ago about the rules and regulations that these federal agencies write, one of the things that I've come across is they're enforcing policies and procedures and rules written here at the local level within a mile of my office, and they're using armed federal agents, and the rule here might be different than the other forest, which is 100 miles away. And they vary from forest to forest to forest, and it's whatever what supervisor wants or whatever the regional office in Portland wants or whatever Washington, D.C. wants. And you can go from one forest to another, and I have at least three national forests in my county that each rule might be different, that there's no off-road travel on this section, but over here you can go wherever you want, and then over here you might get ticketed for it, but over here you might be okay. And it's very confusing and frustrating, and it gets to the point that people are just going to quit going out on the public lands because they're afraid they're either going to get a gun pointed at them or they're going to get arrested or cited. So it's very inconsistent, it's unfair, and it's, who's making these rules to where they're getting cited and being penalized, and it's punitive where they take money out of their pocket and write them a ticket where they have to go to either Pendleton, which is 125 miles, or Eugene, which is a four-hour drive, or to Portland, which is a 5 or 6 hour drive, and who can take off a day of work and go contest these tickets when you're paying $4 a gallon for gasoline and missing a day's work.
Yeah, I that's what I found too, Glenn. We have recently had some 10th Amendment violations. There was a federal case, it's called Bond versus United States, a very recent case, where a female was arrested, I believe it was for trying to poison her husband's girlfriend. Point being, the federal government arrested this woman. According to the 10th Amendment, which is supposed to protect the people, she actually stood up and contested that and won her case. She should have been arrested in the state, and state law enforcement deal with that case, but the feds did it. And what that did is it's huge in that people can and should, I believe, challenge under the 10th Amendment if their due process is being violated. And speaking of due process, that's one of the biggest violations that I see in what these federal law enforcement agents are doing within the forest lands. One quick example.
In that somebody's breathing, you have to, when you're not speaking, go ahead and mute your phone or something. Go ahead.
I have to breathe to talk.
No, I mean, there's a little excessive.
We had a case just in a neighboring county where there's an elderly man, I believe he's 83, and he's got some physical impairments. And they wanted him to file on his mining claim. They wanted him to file a new plan of operation as well as post $4,000 in a bond. And apparently he didn't work fast enough, so law enforcement came in. They disassembled his privately owned and built buildings and then burned them. So he challenged it in federal court, and the judge sided with him that it was a due process violation on the Forest Service side of the house. And there are some solutions that we're going to talk about in this meeting, January 12th, that we want to run by them and, like I say, see if we can work through this.
Here are a couple of quotes. You mentioned the bond case. I'm going to read. I'm reading from your own paper again because these are particularly interesting. The case reads, includes this following statement: anything in repugnance to the Constitution is invalid or unlawful. That's a pretty powerful statement. And then in another case that you quote just above that is the following. Each state in the union is sovereign as to all the power reserved. It must necessarily be so because the United States have no claim to any authority but such as the states have surrendered to them.
Correct.
Pretty powerful statements.
And those are out of court decisions.
Out of legal court decisions, as you have in your paper here.
Yeah.
And there was another one I'm searching for right now, and maybe while I'm searching I'll ask you to explain, and is the idea that the state representatives do not have the power to give away or to diminish the authority or rights of the states themselves.
That's correct.
Correct, absolutely. Our Constitution gives that sole authority and jurisdiction to the sheriff of each county for law enforcement purposes. And the state legislature cannot circumvent that unless they amend our Constitution.
Here's the quote. The constitutional authority of Congress cannot be expanded by the, quote, consent of the governmental unit whose domain is thereby narrowed, whether that unit is the executive branch or the states. In other words, state representatives cannot give away state rights. Another extremely powerful statement here. This is just absolutely a tremendous contribution, Sheriff Gobelson, to the cause. I think this document here has so much in it that is so good. The question, I want to get back to public lands for just a moment, basically solutions. You know, we talked about this a little bit earlier at a prior show, but ultimately here it's not just good enough, I don't think, to talk about these things and complain about these roads being closed without our consent and against our wishes and desires, but to actually do something about it. I mean, ultimately, don't we have to not only just simply not just stop these, but don't we have to begin to reopen these roads?
Glenn?
I agree with you, Kirk. I think we as sheriffs have a duty and an obligation to make sure that the citizens of our communities are protected against bad government, per se. I don't think any other authority is in any position better to do that than the sheriff of each county. I think we have a duty and an obligation when we take our oath of office that when we raise our right hand and swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, we have obligated ourselves to uphold that, and that's what I think Sheriff Gilbertson and I have done. And I know there's quite a few sheriffs in California, and I think we've picked up a few extras here in Oregon that we might see something here within the next month or so that we might see some changes, and hopefully it's for the good and the betterment of our communities and the people that we represent.
That's fantastic. I think we have somebody on the line from area code 406. Did you have a question?
Yes, hello?
Hi.
Hello, this is Kelly Z. I'm actually calling from Eureka. I want to add a little bit more to states' rights in the sense of Prince versus U.S., where Justice Scalia stated very clearly that we have a system of dual sovereignty, states and federal government. Each is duly sovereign to hold each other accountable.
Right. Do you have a question in addition, or you just wanted to make that comment? Because there is clearly this dual issue.
Well, it was close to what we were just talking about.
Okay.
But I do want to throw out something I've been working on here regarding in Siskiyou County, we got problems with the federal agents showing up armed, state agents, they just trespass on private property. One rancher, he was so upset sitting next to Sheriff Lopez, he was telling the fish and game officer, you come on my property, it will be trespassing. It won't be a warning shot. It will be a lethal shot. And there's some frustration there, obviously. I have approached the district attorney with a concept using the grand jury. Now, I know Red Beckman knows about the grand jury. So basically, when these trespasses continue, we want ranchers to not take law in their own hands, We want them to submit a complaint. We said develop a complaint form. It goes to the district attorney, and he's commented. He said, this is very insightful. That's very good. And what we want the DA to do is take these, get to a judge, convene a criminal grand jury, and start indicting the state or federal agents for trespassing.
Why don't we ask this is an interesting question. I don't want to get too off the topic tonight, but we have talked about grand juries in the past. There has been, I know Terry Dodd, who is the regular host of the show, has been a strong advocate of that, and we're going to have more shows on this in the future. But perhaps just quickly, maybe Sheriff Gilbertson or Sheriff Prama, you would like to comment about your thoughts about use of grand juries or civil grand juries.
That's certainly an option that's available to us if we have a DA that is reluctant to pursue these things. It's something that we certainly need to look at. And
the county that Kirk Andrews is very open to it. We're going to meet next week and talk quite a bit more about it.
Yeah, and just to let you know, we're working very closely with your sheriff.
Yeah, Lopey's a good guy.
You bet he is.
And Glenn, did you have any comment you wanted to make on that?
I think if it's a criminal event, and I think if the DA doesn't want to do an information or file charges on his own, and he wants to have a grand jury look at it and review it and see if there's enough for a true bill to be found on it, I think that would be a wise move. And like Sheriff Gilbertson said, if you've got a district attorney that's got a spine that will stand up to these folks and take it before a grand jury and let the grand jury determine whether or not it's criminal enough for an indictment. And if there is, then there is. If there's not, there's not. And let the people decide whether or not they'll pursue criminal charges.
Is it your opinion? Let me ask myself, Palmer and Gilbertson again. Is there anything that, in your opinion, has arisen in all of the cases that you have been involved in that arises to the level that you think that either a civil grand jury or a grand jury should be looking into?
Absolutely. I'd like to comment on that. Right here in our own county, we're dealing with an issue right now where both of them, there's two of them actually, there's two mining issues where Forest Service is doing some salmon restoration work on the middle fork of the John Day River, and they did what's called an environmental assessment where they go in and determine the environmental issues within where they're working in there. And they went on to an active mining claim, and they wrote in their environmental assessment that they knew they had an active mining claim going, and they came onto this guy's private property and took 66,000 cubic yards of tailing piles that he was actively mining and going back through and removing the mineral out of that. He has a private property right to it, and as far as and the Forest Service admitted in their email to him when they communicated with him, no, we don't think we took 66,000 cubic yards. We think we only took between 10 and 15,000 cubic yards. And what they did was they filled in the old channel and got the river back over into the old channel where it slowed it down and got it deeper and made it more, I think it's better for the fish. You know, it made it deeper, slowed it down, made it cooler. But they admitted that they took this guy's mining claim and his mineral off of his mining claim, and I think that would be a good one for a grand jury to look at. And then the other one was we had a retired Forest Service employee that became very vocal in our newspaper, and he wrote several letters to the editor in our newspaper, and he scolded the Forest Service for some of the travel management plans that they were putting out. And they went to work on his mining claim, and they found out that there was a break in the paperwork 26 years ago, and they sent him a notice of eviction to kick him out of his cabin. And basically what they were going to do was break the windows out of the cabin and tear the doors off of it and let the rats and the squirrels and the birds and whatever else take the toll on it. And I went to him and I told him, I said, if there's any federal employees that enter or go into that cabin, they will be arrested. They're not going to go back 26 years. I mean, there was a time that they could have done that. They failed to post it. They failed to notify the county assessor that to stop assessing taxes on that cabin. This guy paid his bills. He was up front. He's a fairly good citizen in our community, outstanding citizen as far as I know. And they tried to take the cabin from him. And I think that one would be another one that would be a good grand jury review on. I think when you're trying to take something, it's no more than a theft. And it's just because you work for the government doesn't mean that you can go commandeer these things without the proper authority or giving these people the due process. And I think you could probably sense my frustration and anger in dealing with these things, that why are we allowing our government to treat the people that we represent in this fashion? So
Let me jump off. I got Terry Dodd on the line now. I want Terry to kind of join the conversation. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Kurt, for covering for me tonight. I don't have just a minute, but I just wanted to make a quick comment about the civil grand jury. You had the caller that called in asking about the civil grand jury being able to indict for the trespass. And civil grand juries in California do not have the ability or the authority to indict. They actually operate off of a little bit different jury pool situation, and because of that, they are not like a regular grand jury that is an indicting grand jury. They are not issued bills of indictment, and but there's no reason they can't investigate it, and there's also no reason why they can't go back to the Superior Court or the prosecutors and ask them to further or pass this on to a regular grand jury or further investigate it. But civil grand juries do not indict.
Well, I understand that. Yeah, actually, that's why I'm meeting with the district attorney, because if he gets enough complaints, he'll develop a complaint form, basically check the box, fill in some information, get it the DA. He gets enough, he'll go to a judge. California PC, Penal Code 904, says the judge shall convene a grand jury when in the best interest of the public. I'm going criminal. That's my approach, and that's why I got to get with the DA. In fact, Anders, in the first 3 days of office, he convened a criminal grand jury. So I think he's real favorable towards pursuing that. I got a couple questions for the sheriffs. Is there a concern that if you go and arrest a federal or a state agent that your department or you personally might get sued?
Well, that possibility always exists. You know, we knew that coming into this office. Anything you do, the liability hangs over your head. I'm not personally concerned about that. You know, if it happens, it happens, and we'll deal with it.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is because, I believe, I've written a book. It's called The Hidden Fourth Branch. It's about the power of the grand jury. And what I understand is when you get a criminal grand jury indictment, and basically you have to do your duty and go and arrest them, in which that would protect you from a lot of lawsuits because you're just doing your duty. Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, basically with an indictment, you would end up with a warrant, and that would be our authority to arrest.
And so you wouldn't have the legal challenges by fish and game. Or it'd be easily dismissed because you're just doing your duty. You got handed a grand jury indictment.
Well, we agree with that.
Okay, I'm gonna jump back in here because we're running. I want to wrap this
Hello?
Up within about 10 minutes or so. Is that you, Red?
It's Rex.
No, this is that's not Red. I'm keeping
Red,
quiet.
Did you want to say something, Red?
No, not right now.
Okay. So what I'd like to do now is kind of step away from the grand jury thing, because we're going to have another future show again on that, where the entire show will be dedicated to that. What I would like to do, though, is I'd like to give, you know, both sheriffs a chance to kind of give out some closing thoughts and statements to this segment of the show.
Could I make?
Glenn, go ahead.
Go ahead. So, you know, Doberson, you want to go ahead and do that?
Well, yeah, I don't have too much else to offer other than, you know, when I took this office and took the oath, I thought I knew what I was, I thought I understood what that oath meant. Little did I realize what cost it could be to actually stand up and you know, stand behind that oath. And I'm okay with all that. It's the right thing to do. I believe in this Constitution. I fought in Vietnam, Bosnia, Kosovo, and Iraq, and have been law enforcement just about all my life. And we need to keep this America what it was designed for. We need to keep it as a republic. It's the best kind of government that has ever been throughout history. None of the other ones have made it for very long. So, you know, we just need to stand up and do the right thing.
Okay, and Sheriff Palmer, Glenn?
You know, I don't know that I have anything to add, Kirk. I think I can just pretty much ride on the coattails of what Gil said, and I firmly believe in our oath of office, and sheriffs need to read the Constitution of the United States and their respective states, and pick up the phone and call your local sheriff and find out where they stand, and when they do make a stand, if it fits within what you believe in, you know what, support that sheriff, and he's not doing this, and I'm speaking for myself, but I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing it for the people that have put me in office, and it's I never in my wildest dreams ever thought that I would stand toe-to-toe with a federal officer like I did and tell him you need to stop doing what you're doing. And it's not fun, it's not pleasant, but what I see is happening to the people that I represent, I would not tolerate one of my officers treating the public the way they've been treated. And that's what's kind of got me to where I'm at today, and then I started studying some things, and you know, we have a duty and an obligation to represent our people, and just keep one thing in mind. The Constitution of the United States restricts and prohibits and limits what the government can do. It doesn't empower them. It restricts them and limits them, and it empowers the people, and the people still have control of their government, not the other way around. And that's what I'm hoping we can do with this, is turn the table a little bit and get this back to some sensibility and some reasonableness in what's happening in our communities, and get some jobs back in our communities, and give the people the control of what their government does. And I just can't say it enough that people need to go in and sit down with their sheriff and find out where they stand, and when they do make a stand, is to make sure the citizens stand behind them or stand with them and support them and encourage them. And I think that's probably about it, Kirk. So.
Okay, well, you guys are doing a phenomenal job. Before I make any final comments, let me just invite the next speaker. Ron, if you're listening in, you need to dial in because you're on, or we'll be shortly here. I think this whole issue of understanding jurisdiction of these public lands really is a vital issue. And for people who I encourage you again, get this document and then go ahead and pass it out to everybody you know. Send it out to your email list. Discuss it in your Tea Party groups or your meetings that you attend, and go through that, because it appears that, you know, they have gone way beyond any kind of constitutional boundary here, and we need to understand that in order to be able to, I think, have an effective response. Let me just see if Ron, hang on just one second while
Kirk, I'm going to just Gil on. I'm going to have to bail out. I've got to get somewhere.
Thank you very much, Gil. I appreciate it.
Right. Happy New Year to you guys.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. All right, so we've wrapped up this segment of the show, and I need, do we have another caller? Area code 480, you want to go live? Hello? Do we have somebody online from area code 480? Okay, we'll go ahead and try and see if we can catch the another line here.
Yeah. You're just on job.
Well, go ahead.
Okay.
Hello, do we have somebody on the line there? Sorry, I can't hear you too well there. All right. Well, I think at this point in time, I'm waiting for our next show host, our next guest to come on. Apparently hasn't come on yet. If I could, Red, could I ask you to take over for a couple of minutes, and I'll take a time and see if I can find our next guest.
I will try to keep this thing going.
Sorry about that. That'd be great.
Yeah, I like to tell people that I first started speaking out publicly and quite loud in 1975. And I was a very, very lonesome kind of a guy. Everybody thought I was crazy, and that was not easy to take from the family. But I had enough background in history and military service, of course, and one thing another, so that I knew that I was correct in what I was saying. And I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction from programs which we've had here the last 3 weeks or so, listening to these sheriffs and these people that are getting themselves informed, and they're stepping right up and into the battle. And so I'm not lonesome anymore. I am fairly confident that what we have going on in our nation today is a massive re-education. We have failed our children. We were failed at my age. When I was in high school and such, they were already teaching propaganda rather than history. And that's a long time ago, because I'm 83 now, so you can look back to the 40s and 30s, and we were not taught the truth about our system even then. And so I had to start at, you might say, ground zero, and I had to trash can a lot of what I had believed from my education system, the education that I got in the public schools. Now, this is so important that we have our county sheriffs becoming involved, because they can be a real force in their counties, and it's vital that these gentlemen in Northern California and Southern Oregon that are having all these problems with federal agents and such, it's very, very important that they win here in the future in their confrontations, for the simple reason that all of California will be affected. If they win, I can assure you that some of this will go all the way down the Pacific coast, all the way to Mexico, because they've got a lot of problems with federal government in a lot of different places in California. And so the state of California, they need a big win. And I think we can see it coming. I know we can. It's going to come, because these federal agencies and such are out of line, and they are only able to operate as they do because the people don't know the truth. They don't know the law. They don't know about our American history. They don't know what the Constitution was trying to secure for them. And so it's a learning process that's going on in this country right now, and I'm just thrilled to death with it, because, 25, 30 years ago, people were asking me at meetings and such that I spoke out all over this nation. They'd say, when are we going to be able to turn this around? And I told them, I said, it's not going to happen. We're not going to be successful until we have an economic meltdown. And when that happens, people are going to be, they're going to be shook out of their slumber and their sleep and such, and they're going to wake up and say, hey, we've got to bring this thing back to what it was supposed to be. And so I want to make a recommendation right here. If there's people out there that want to get better informed, I would recommend they go back and read the history from 1215 A.D. King John of England said that he owned all the land. The people didn't own any land. They were just tenants on the ground, on the land. They were serfs. And they had to pay the king a percentage of what they produced. And the barons, the administrators in the king's government, sat down and wrote Magna Carta. And the reason I say we go back there, Magna Carta is still the law of this land. Magna Carta was not trash canned when the founders created our Constitution.
Can you blog?
And what the Magna Carta... What? Magna Carta took the king and put him on the bottom of the pecking order, and it put the people themselves at the top. And we, the people of this country, we've been kind of demoted to the lower position in our system. And we want to get back on top, and we're on our way. It's happening, and if you want to get into some exciting living, why, get on board. Kurt, did you get...
I think we may have Ron on. Ron, are you on the line now? Ron, are you there? I can't hear Ron if he's on the line.
Hello?
Yeah, is that Ron there?
No, this is Rex.
Hi, Rex. No, we're looking for Ron here. Rex, go ahead. What did you have? You had a question or comment?
Yeah, I'm very frustrated, you know, I've been on hold all this long. But at any rate, my comment was, oh, hell. Yes, I did. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm here, still live.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm very frustrated. I've been on hold for over an hour. But I wanted to comment to Gil Gilbertson and his associate there, and I've talked to Gil before but about what a great job they're doing. But I wanted to point out something, and that is that they should look at Title 42, Chapter 1, Subchapter 1, Section 1983 of the Federal Code of Justice, because that allows people like Bond in the case that Gil quoted, Bond versus U.S., that allows people like Bond or the minor that they took his tailings, et cetera, it allows them to sue whoever did it, the actual people doing it, government officials. And basically what that says in there, Kurt, it says that any citizen or resident of the United States who has their civil rights violated under any common usage law, local law, federal law, state law, et cetera, can sue that person or those people in a civil court of law. not criminal but civil, which means that the federal government cannot protect him. And once they sue him in a civil court of law, it's a pretty simple thing, particularly if it's a jury trial, to get a judgment. And once they get a judgment of however much they're asking for, then if that person doesn't have the funds to pay that, say, $300,000 judgment, then the person doing the suing can take their pension, their car, their home, and everything else. And we need to start doing that.
Okay, Rex, I appreciate the input. If you would, Rex, would you just drop me an email at Kirk, K-I-R-K, at defendruralamerica.com, because I want to hear more of what you will have to say. But right now we're going to see if we can go back and have our second guest on. But thank
okay,
you very
Kirk,
much.
Give me that again. Kirk at what?
Kirk, K-I-R-K, at defendruralamerica.com.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Rex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do we have Ron? Are you there now?
Yeah, I'm on. Can you hear me okay, Kirk?
Yeah, all good. Gotcha.
Fantastic.
Well,
what a great show you're having tonight. This is just fantastic.
Well, thank you. Listen, let me kind of bring the audience. Sorry for the delays and the hookups here. Not quite clear what all happened. But we're going into a second topic now. This is Ron Artino. Ron is with the one of the Central Valley Tea Parties, the Aubrey chapter. He's also a hydrologist. So what we're now going to be talking about for the remainder of this show is going to be hydropower and dams, because the whole Siskiyou County story starts with the government's desires to blow up or partially blow up these dams and return these rivers to, quote, a natural condition. And part of the story is hydropower, which is something that, you know, I think I'm like most Americans, you forget about it. I mean, you know, dams do something and they generate power and I see lines coming out of it, but you don't give it a second thought. Well, our guest, Ron Artino, has been thinking about that. He's been actively involved in this since, what, 1978?
About 1985 is when I actually became an operator.
And an operator in 1985. Mm-hmm. So why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of your background there, Ron?
Thank you, Kirk. And indeed, hydroelectric generation is the oldest resource as far as generation goes in the country, in the world. Its design initially was generators at lower RPMs, and in those days they used to what we call shoot hot lines constantly. So the design of a hydroelectric generator is much more bold and strong than the current bulk load systems we have now with steam generators. Steam generators can be any way you boil water. It can be through coal, natural gas, of course, nuclear. They've got, alternatives like burning tires. Any way you can burn, boil steam to make a turbine spin. The point with steam generators is they spin at high RPMs, and they're good for bulk load, but you can't ramp their load up and down rapidly like you can a hydro generator.
So I'm going to use another term you used in a prior conversation I had with you. You essentially have hydropower here based on water. You have a bunch of energy sources that fit in this category called steam generators or combustion type deals. Anyway, they're steam-oriented. And then we have these newer things like wind power and solar power and so forth. So the major parts today are these kind of hydropower and these combustion or steam-oriented ones. And the ability of hydropower to, or the essential need of hydropower to running our national grid is a result of the fact that the power you can ramp up quickly. Is that correct?
Very true. And that's the problem with the steam generator, in that they spin at such high RPMs, 3,600 RPM, that they're very difficult to ramp up and down. And as a matter of fact, nuclear generators can take as long as a month to come up to full load. And that's an advantage of a hydroelectric generator, is their ability to ramp energy in and out of the grid at a rapid rate. There can be over 1,000 megawatts in and out of the grid in a 10-minute ramp.
So essentially, we guys should back up during the course of a day, and from day to day it varies, and week to month and so forth, it varies season to season. But basically, in the course of a day, energy is being produced and consumed instantaneously, you know, moves at the speed of light. So essentially, whenever we turn on a light bulb and our neighborhoods turn on our lights or our heating or air conditioning, you know, somewhere back there, somebody has to be generating that power instantaneously. So the demand for energy is going up and down throughout the course of a day, and something has to be turned up or, you know, speeded up or slowed down, turned on, turned off, in order to generate the power that we need throughout the day. And the one that you're saying does that the best is hydropower. It can go from 0 to 100% in 10 minutes, correct?
Exactly, Kirk, and let me try to explain this as simply as I can. In the power grid, the Western States power grid is about from the Mississippi River west. It's one rolling mass of energy. That energy travels at 60 cycles a second. That's a speed to the load. So when you turn that light switch on and off, those electrons have to travel through the wires to that light bulb filament to light it up the second you turn it on. Well, that's 60 watts of load coming from the grid. Now, if you can imagine a city when the sun starts to rise and everybody turns their lights on pretty much simultaneously, possibly within 15 minutes, monitoring the grid, we can see that deflection of load. And that has to be answered by generation because we send electricity at a given speed, 60 cycles a second. That speed can't deviate a tenth of a cycle without doing damage to either your appliances or equipment, being lines, transformers, and generators.
So basically, as that demand is ramping up or being down, you know, there's adjustment going on. And without that kind of adjustment, the power generation, we can't operate the grid effectively. There can be some serious damage done. Is that right?
Correct. As I was an apprentice, the best illustration I saw on this was a simple teeter-totter, where it's balanced in the center on the fulcrum. And any time you start to put a little bit of weight on one side, that balance goes off and it starts to teeter. You have to answer that opposite balance on the other side to keep that teeter-totter horizontal or flat. And that's the same thing with an electric power grid, that when everybody turns their lights on, or like you say, when industry starts, and that goes back to a Saturday morning is a whole lot different than a Monday morning. We're going to have a whole lot more demand on a Monday morning than we would on a Saturday morning. Conversely, winter and summer, we're going to have whole different kinds of demands on that Saturday or Monday, whether the weather's hot or cold. So we have to anticipate this kind of a load on a grid, and it's a very fragile grid indeed. But we're keeping this balance of the teeter-totter that when there's load added to it, we have to answer that with generation to keep that speed of electricity at 60 cycles. Additionally, that's why we can't store electricity. It has to be delivered upon demand.
Now, I think that it kind of makes an interesting contrast if you take wind and solar, and, you know, you have no control. The sun either shining or isn't. I mean, I guess you have some control, but not very much. The sun's either shining or not shining, or you got wind or you don't got wind. I presume that in order to be able to take advantage of these quote-unquote green energy sources, the only way to take advantage of those is to have something else that's able to accommodate their swings up and down.
Exactly right. Wind and solar come in and out of the grid at an unpredictable rate, and that's obvious whether the sun rises and a cloud goes behind it or whether the wind blows at night or day. So they're very unpredictable sources, and they'll never be a large portion of the grid. They can never be a large portion of the grid, or you would have a very unstable grid. Now, in this, what we've illustrated here in this fluctuation of load, whether it's you turning your lights on a Saturday or a Monday, or wind and solar coming in and out of the grid, this all has to be responded to and balanced out. So wind and solar can throw a grid off. Now, going back to the speed of a steam generator, they're very critical that you can't change their load factors very much. When they come up to load, they stay there. And when they come down off of load, that's it. They're offline. Now, the really big advantage of hydro generators is their ability to respond to these load changes. I've witnessed many times the 1,000 megawatts on our project come into the grid and out of the grid in 10 minutes. And ramps like this up and down all day long. And what this is we're responding to load changes, and we're making that grid more stable. And this is one thing that has been neglected in hydroelectric energy, and it's something that as we think about blowing up dams, for one thing, we're losing water, and water is a very valuable commodity, at least in my life. I need water every day, a lot of it, and very clean. But beyond that, this energy, this low cost of this energy, it's not been considered an alternate renewable energy source, which has boggled my mind from the get-go, because there's nothing more alternate and renewable than hydroelectric. But yeah, its big advantage is responses in the grid in these voltage changes and these load changes, where hydro can respond rapidly to all of these load changes. No other generating source can.
And it was interesting because, you know, I've been kind of learning about the benefits of these dams and hydroelectric power and hydropower. And the one I had not heard until you and I had talked before was about not only is it, you know, has all these positive benefits, but it's actually critical. You know, it keeps the grid functioning, or at least it's part of the equation that helps to keep the grid functioning, you know, versus, I guess, these combustible kinds of fuels. I suppose they have the ability to ramp up or down a little bit too, but nothing close to what the hydropower is able to do. What are some of the additional advantages, you know, having worked on dams, that you see for hydropower?
Well, we talked about our ability to come in and out of the grid at 10-minute ramps, so that's extremely important, okay? It has a non-consumption-based energy source as far as its fuel. There's no trucks bringing water into the powerhouses. They're natural rainfall, and, of course, it helps if you have mountain ranges so you can have waterfall where you can trap that water. When you trap water, In theory, it's basically about for every foot of elevation you have trapped, that's a half a pound of pressure. So if you have 1,000 feet of water column, you have about 500 pounds of pressure that you can push a turbine with. So its water source is based on its energy is a non-consumable, like you're not hauling in gasoline to feed these generators. Comparing it to solar and wind, you got about a half a cent a kilowatt hour is the cost of production of hydroelectric, where when you go to solar, it's between 30 and 40 cents a kilowatt hour to produce those two energy sources. When you get into any steam product, they rival between 20 and 30 cents to produce a kilowatt hour of it. And that's mainly because in hydro, I know on the project that I worked on for 30 years, We're automated now, but you basically have one person, and I worked it out. It's 75% of the time in a day or a week, 75% of the time one person is operating 1,000 megawatts, taking it in and out of the grid. In a typical steam plant, you have up to 300 people per shift operating that plant, which raises the price per kilowatt hour. So a big advantage with hydro is its cost is a half a cent a kilowatt hour. It's alternate renewable, whether they say so or not. It's carbon-free. As far as reliability, it is very reliable. We'll get into black start here in a minute. And you can't get any cheaper than the cost of hydroelectric.
Yeah, it just seems like it's kind of the magic thing. This whole thing about consumption, too, is interesting to me as we are talking. And I'll kind of restate what you said because I think it's so important. You know, coal is an energy source, or wood, or gas, or whatever. You know, in the process of generating heat, heat or electricity is consumed. It's burned. It's consumed. And as a result of that, you know, it has to be replenished. You have to get more of it from somewhere, and ultimately you have to figure out how to replenish that supply. And it actually has to be, you know, dug up, or it has to be, you know, cut down or something. You have some cost to actually get that. You have to transport to the plant, and you have to transport the waste from the plant. None of that exists with hydropower.
Zero.
No consumption, nothing. The water comes, you know, you put the dam in the middle of the water flow, and the water flows through, and you get power, and there's really nothing going on other than the turbines are turning and the water is flowing, and the water doesn't get consumed in the process.
That's
also
correct.
remarkably clean.
It's so true, but beyond all that, we're talking an energy source here, which, you know, when your lights go out, that's when you really start to value electricity. That's when you really start to think about where did this come from and when am I going to get it back. And everybody out there know that when your lights go out, there are people risking their lives to get that power back on, literally risking their lives. And I've seen some men lose their lives keeping this power on. So it's a very courageous and heroic effort that's done to keep this fragile grid going. And there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that people don't know and they take for granted. But yeah, it's a really marvelous thing.
I'd like to, Dr. Kate's, you know, in the back of the scenes on all these shows, she's making sure all the connections are working and everything else, but, you know, she has a hydraulic background here. Kay, would you like to kind of jump in here a bit and say anything or ask any questions?
Hi, Kirk, and good evening, everyone. You know, Ashley, what I really want to know is what's going on. You know, they cannot justify the removal of these dams on the Klamath system by hydroelectric, that it's not worth it because it's obviously contributing to regional energy supplies. They can't really justify it based on water quality, and they can't justify it really based on fish because, you know, they can put a fish ladder in if they wanted to do that and make other efforts and so forth. So what is your view of what's going on? You're the scientist, hydrologist working in this area. What do you think's going on here? And just for our audience, tell us what would be the unbelievably ridiculous impacts of removing these dams. So it's kind of a two-part question, technical, and one is your view politically. What the heck is going on here? Thanks, Kirk. I'll drop back in the background now.
Okay.
Well, Kirk, politically, in my observation with what's going on here, is they want us out of the mountains. And I know Agenda 21 is really, it's a UN agenda for sustainable development. And that's what I've seen over the 20-plus years I've been up in these mountains, is that what we could do 20 years ago, we can't do nowadays, and they want us out of here. Similar to what your program was the first hour with the sheriffs, you see the efforts going on for years to get people out of these mountains.
And I think Greg was also asking what the second part of the question was, what happens, what's the implication of removing these dams from the hydropower part of this equation?
As I return to that question, I'm just, in a way, I'm flabbergasted. What are you going to drink for dinner tonight? What I see is what value do you put on water? And we can't store enough water. It's absolute lunacy to take these dams out like they're doing. I know in California, our former Governor Schwarzenegger had a water bond that he decided to take off the 2010 election. But part of this water bond, from what I understand, is tearing other dams down in the state. And this is one of the political ploys to and in this water bond, they want to build another dam, but it wouldn't build the dam. The water bond wouldn't build the dam. It would start the studies to build the dam. Of course, with government, that would be 20, 30 years down the road. But part of it was to tear out other dams. And often when we see in legislation, the way legislation is written up, it hides what's really going on within that legislation. And that's why I got involved with Tea Parties, because so often we vet the legislation and the candidates and find out what's really going on behind this legislation. And I urge people to pay attention to the tea parties, because we are looking at all these legislations, and we're going to vet them for limited government, free markets, and fiscal responsibility.
Ron, how would people get hold of you in the Central Valley?
Well, we have centralvalleyteaparty.org, and then you can go to the groups. I'm with the Auberry Group, A-U-B-E-R-R-Y. And there's a phone number in there that's offered, too, that they could get hold of us at, too.
Okay, thank you. I agree with you wholeheartedly. People need to get active and to educate themselves. Before we move on, I want to touch upon another topic. Is there anything further you want to talk about in terms of hydropower?
I just want to emphasize how important it is and enlighten people to how fragile the power grid is and how absolutely important hydroelectric energy is to that power grid. I know in the state of California, we've got the Sierra Nevada mountains. We could be energy independent in this state, but we seem to keep shooting ourselves in the foot over this.
Yeah. Let me move you then to another part of the another topic here, because we had a chance to talk about this before, and I was fascinated. Can you tell me about this one-square-foot window?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, over the years, what I've observed also in as working for a utility is we seem to be being groomed more and more to become a government bureaucracy. And that's definitely what I've observed over the years is the different hoops you have to jump through just to get something done. You hear about in the military that $10,000 toilet seat. Well, I see some similar things going on with utilities, and it's just government regulations that we have to follow. One was a window got broken in my powerhouse, and, of course, I reported it and expected people to come down the next day and fix this little thing for a limited amount of money. But what I found was months and months of delay, because this little 12 by 12-inch window needed to be – the glazing on it needed to be tested for asbestos content and lead content. Those two tests in themselves took a couple months to get the results back for this thing.
So they sent out people in bunny suits to take samples of the glazing, correct?
That's correct, and of course we have to train them with hazardous material waste, and so these individuals came down as a crew to collect these little piles of glazing that are so common in everybody's house, but we have to follow government regulations, and we had to abide by this, you know. So it took several months to get the test results back from the lead and the asbestos content in the thing. And then we started to fix it, and then we got interrupted with a historical study on the whole thing. So we had to do a historical study on this window that took several more months to find out that we had some replacement panes, which I knew about the first day it happened, in the basement that were the same vintage. And that's what I honestly expected, is the crews to come down the next day and grab one of them pre-cut panes and put that puppy in there, and off they go.
Let me back up just 1 second. You're required, the public utility company, not you personally, but the company is required, when a window is broken, to replace it with glass of the same vintage, the same year or production?
Yeah, and this is mostly because our powerhouse has been designated a historic landmark, even though they're ready at any moment we expect them to tear out all the dams and everything, but it's been declared a historical landmark. It's approaching 100 years old. As a matter of fact, in next year it will be 100 years old. And so the government tends to step in and bully the utility around on what they can do and can't do, where we knew we had the vintage window downstairs and we could have replaced this thing. And you know, I got to go along with the asbestos and lead. If that's what we got to do, then let's do it that way. Let's do it the right way. But what it came down to is this window ended up costing thousands of dollars. And I see this in so many other routines that we do nowadays that we used to do relatively easily 20 years ago that now are roadblock after roadblock after roadblock for getting the job done.
How long did it take before the window got actually replaced?
That one was nearly a year. That one was nearly a year.
A year. And the utility company is not a government agency. I mean, government's bad enough. This kind of thing, horror story we hear about government wasting our money, but this is not a government agency, but apparently they're under the thumb of government, correct?
That's correct, and I know your listeners will relate to this, and that's compliance, compliance to government regulations. So many industries nowadays have whole compliance departments that have to have libraries of book upon book upon book on government regulations. When if we just did things with common sense and natural law, that would eliminate so much of that. And it goes
back. How many full-time people are working there on compliance?
In the department, in my little hydro department, out of 200 employees, there's at least 10. So that's 5 to 10% of our workforce in our little department is dedicated to compliance. Now, when you start going on with maybe 30,000 employees, you're talking several thousand of them are dedicated totally to compliance regulations.
And it's amazing to me. Essentially, these are government agents. I mean, they're not government agents in terms of, I mean, how their outlook is and anything else, but effectively government has been able to get and force in the private sector to effectively create people who perform the function of government agents. And there's 10 of them where there used to be zero.
That's correct. And the rules we have to follow can be state or federal.
Amazing.
So you have
to know. Tell the listeners about the elderberry bush.
Yeah, we have elderberry bushes that grow on our property, and it's an elderberry. It's what you make elderberry wine, elderberry jellies out of, and so on, you know. Because they grow on our property on the utilities land, and there's been a beetle that's called the elderberry beetle that can only mate on the elderberry bush, and it's been designated about 20 years ago an endangered species. And now they think it's not endangered, but it takes years to get off the books as an endangered species. Consequently, there's several months of the year that no employees are allowed to go near an elderberry bush, or you'll be terminated. And so we have safety meetings, environmental meetings on this bush and when to go near it and when not, and where it's been identified on the project and where it hasn't been. Oddly enough, when you drive off the project, elderberry bushes are so predominant in these mountains that they hang out in roads, and cars drive by, trucks drive by and clip them and hit them, and it's not an issue if it's not on government, on utilities land. The government likes to bully the utilities around and fine us, inspect us, regulate us to no end. And ultimately what I have to tell the people is when a utility gets fined and regulated, the customer is going to pay the price. So you're not picking on the big utility, you're picking on yourself.
Let's give a little background, I guess. It's been determined that this particular beetle only procreates on elderberry bushes, and it's a three-month period of time during the year. Is that correct?
That's about what I understand it is, yes, yes. And you can't get near that bush. Boy, you don't even want to go near that bush, or you will lose your job.
And if I understand that there's people that actually come, they drive into the site, and they have to go find every single elderberry bush on the property and mark it?
And map it and put it on a map.
And map it.
And report to the Forest Service where these elderberry bushes are at.
Well, they send them back to the central database.
That's it. And there's other regulations that I've encountered over the years that are just sometimes they're crazy regulations that do no good. And what I gotta tell people out there is utility employees pay utility bills also, and we really, really try to do our job as efficient and effective as we possibly can.
Give us the one final example about the truck wash.
That's with what we call noxious weeds. That's weeds that are non-native to the mountains where I live at. We have several varieties of weeds up here that are noxious. We got one called tarweed, and it takes over meadows and pasture lands and doesn't allow the forest or meadow to grow through it, and it's just what it says. It's very tarry. Livestock doesn't eat it. It's a bad weed. Another one's called bear clover. It's not from around here. Bears don't like it, and it's not clover, but it does the same thing. It chokes the forest out. Well, these noxious weeds are brought up by people and vehicles and maybe livestock and so on. But with the utilities, they're regulated to a point that we have to have wash racks, that when a truck comes into this area, they have to go through this wash rack to wash all the possibly noxious seeds and everything out of the tires and up under the wheel wells and so on, you know. Same thing going out, it has to be washed. Yet all other vehicles coming in and out of here, private horse trailers, private people, hunters, they don't have to go through this. So you're beating up on the utility and making them spend money on things that, yeah, you don't want noxious weeds up here, but there's an ineffective way to do this. But the government seems to beat up the utilities because we got this big pocketbook here. It's really the consumer. It's really the customer that's paying the price on all this stupid regulations.
Now, this is one that actually seems pretty well-intended because I don't think people want to have those noxious weeds, the ranchers, the farmers, or anybody else probably want to have them up there. So it seems like it's well-intended. The idea is pretty good until you, I guess, kind of consider the fact if you take a freeway or take a road and just look how many of those trucks are actually from, you know, PG&E or Edison, mm-hmm. as a percentage of the traffic, it's minuscule.
That's
so the
correct.
Application of this to, you know, just this minuscule portion of the vehicle seems to be a regulation that, you know, kind of nuts because it's not going to accomplish the end result. I mean, if private cars and other cars are driving up there, trucks, trailers, all this kind of stuff, they're going to be potentially carrying seeds up as well.
That's correct, yeah. And it goes back to people have gotten used to the government taking care of them from cradle to grave, and we've got to let go of that thought, that we've got to get back to common sense. I know this utility up here, you know, it was, like I say, we've been up here in these mountains about 100 years. Right away, we realized when we put the first dam up that we have to create fish water. So out of every dam, we release an amount of water to keep the stream below it dry or wet year-round. We weren't told by the government to do this. We knew this, and this was something we thought was very wise and part of being a good neighbor in the mountains up here. Then when the government started getting along and the Forest Service started getting more and more involved with this, they started bullying the utilities around for what your fish release was, and it wasn't. If we said 3 cubic feet per second, they would say 4 cubic feet per second. And it gets back to, we were good stewards of the land. We didn't need the Forest Service to tell us how to keep land or to keep the forest recycled. But now the Forest Service does it, and it just costs everybody more money.
Well, I think these examples probably were shocking to me. They're probably equally informative, at least to the audience. I really appreciate, Ron, your time to come on the show tonight. Any final thoughts?
I wanted to touch black start. Do we have time to explain that a little bit, the ability for hydro generators to black start a power grid?
Sure.
I'll try to be real fast with it, and that's exactly what I said. Black start is when you have a black grid. It's totally de-energized. Now, to re-energize that grid, hydro generators have become very valuable. And in the state of California, we recognized that back in the 70s when half of the East Coast was lost to a fault, when the power just went down to the whole East Coast, we started thinking out here on the West Coast, what are we going to do if that happens here? So we started picking our brains and figured out how to black start a circuit so that when the power goes down like this, hydro generators are the most reliable source to black start a grid, in that we have our power in lakes. We have our stored energy in lakes above us that can spin the generator. We can excite the generator and send hot lines out to the world and build that grid back up.
Ron, thank you so much for your time. And Red, if you're there, would you like to, I think we only have a minute or so left, would you like to give us a closing prayer?
I can do that. Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the time which has been used here to reach our fellow countrymen with the facts, with the truth,
And we thank you for that, and we just pray that you would help us to put that value on truth that we really need in this country, because truth has become such a scarce commodity, especially coming from the government. And we just pray that you would help us to restore servant government rather than...
But I think we may have lost Red, so we're going to close off the show. I want to thank everybody, and I definitely want to thank Terry Dodd for being kind enough to let me guest host in his place, and Dr. Cade and Red Beckman. Thank you, everybody, so much, and have a happy new year.